Medical Officer of the San Francisco Regional Office of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and he'll be speaking on Medicare access and other late-breaking topics.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I mean that sincerely, not only because of my interest in public health, but because the agency I'm from, which I'll call it CMS, has not been a major participant in APHA's meetings in the past, in large part, and there's a reason for that I'm going to get into in a little bit here. So I am very happy to be with you here this morning. I was told I had to put this slide in, so I did. I have no disclosures. I want to just really briefly hit on health reform. Dr. Schaefer really set up the stage well for me, so I don't need to talk much about it at a high level. But then I want to delve into a little bit about what it means at CMS, both in terms of access, which was an area I was asked to talk about, but go beyond that because I think it's important in terms of tying it all together. We've already covered some of this in this session, but I think it's very important to say, and I think everyone in this room knows, that we were on an unsustainable path. Reform has to happen no matter who's wins the election. We have been in a situation in Medicare, as Dr. Schaefer pointed out, we were headed towards insolvency by 2017 without the Affordable Care Act. Even with it, it's pushed out. The latest estimates are 2025. So we've got to do something, like I say, regardless of who's in charge. And if you look at the expenditures just for Part A, which is what funds hospitals under Medicare, our expenditures have been exceeding the income into that program since 2007, 3 years before the Affordable Care Act. Again, it's not a problem that's going away. Dr. Schaefer also talked about value very quickly, about the fact that despite the fact we spend about twice as much as any other country per capita, our quality metrics are nowhere near where they should be. And in fact, if you look at regional analyses and a number of different analyses, you'll see there's this bizarre inverse relationship, or appears to be, where areas that spend more, at least for Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries, actually do worse in quality. So we have very much issues that we have to address. Now, this is the one slide I really have that directly talks about Medicare providers and accepting new patients. And this is a concern. I don't know how many of you have heard from folks in your area that they've had a hard time finding docs accepting Medicare patients. You know, we do hear that. We hear it in pockets. When we delve into it and we keep annual numbers, right now in 2012, 96% of providers say they're accepting Medicare patients. So that's not to say there aren't some pockets of the country where there are real issues, particularly under certain Medicare health plans that people have signed up for. And this slide actually reflects that over a period of a decade, there has been a change in the number of physicians that are accepting new patients by type of insurance and physician specialty. So these are not, this is data from the NAMCIS, the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, and not the data that we collect internally from physicians. So I'm not here to answer definitively how much of an issue there is around access, but what I do want to talk about are all the things we know that this is going to be a growing problem, especially with the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of the insured population, which we very much want to see. Going back just a little bit to set the stage for this, we've already mentioned, Dr. Schaefer mentioned several of these. I do want to just make certain that everybody caught the pre-existing condition insurance program has been in effect in every state, either run by the state or by us, for now 2 years. So that is available. We have over 80,000 individuals who are previously unable to get insurance who are insured. In California, it's 10,000, over 10,000 alone. And similarly, with the young adults, we now have over 3 million young adults who are insured under their parents' insurance. So these are real. They're already happening. Be very interesting to see what would happen if they actually tried to repeal the entire ACA. The part under development, as you all know, is the mandate to expand both Medicare or expand both commercial and Medicaid. And that enrollment starts less than a year away now. So that's what we're really talking about in terms of what I mean, yes, there are pockets of problems where there are access now. But what happens if we really have up to 32 million new people that are insured? We need to be doing a lot to get ready for that. And any of you who work with health plans or healthcare provider organizations are doing very much in the planning stages for that right now. But at CMS, what are we doing to be prepared? You know, it's not just enough to have access. We really feel we're very strongly committed to this three-part aim. And I want to, you know, this is old stuff to most people now, that we want better health care and a better experience of care. We need lower cost. We need better population health. But there are a couple things that are very different for us at CMS. I mean, we, up until very recently, we paid claims. You know, we made sure that the services that were authorized were paid and paid promptly. But we didn't think about population health. We didn't think about how to lower cost through improvement, and we're very committed to that. I mean, if we can't figure out how to improve care and simultaneously lower costs, at some point the hatchet is going to come and it may not be applied in a way that any of us would like to see. So as simple as this is, it's really ground-changing at CMS, and I mean, that's why I came to CMS a few years ago. This is the underpinning for every new program we roll out, that we have to really take seriously the commitment to achieve all three of these aims. So we have a number of patient system reforms that I think move us much more in line with those of you who are fully committed to public health, and I'm going to talk about those fairly quickly. The ones I did want to hit, because these are directly relevant to the issue of access and access to primary care physicians, there is a bonus that's paid for primary care physicians as well as general surgeons now. That's actually a 10% incentive payment that they'll be getting, that they began getting in January of 2011, and that runs through the entire year of 2015. It was also part of it that primary care providers who accept Medicaid patients have to be paid at least on par with Medicare fee for the physician fee schedule for 2013 and 2014. So that's just going into effect in the very near future. There's also increased geographic payment adjustments, which not everyone's a winner, but in 42 states and territories that will result in an increased physician payment. There are some other things that are not directly payment related, but should make things better for primary care providers. The small employer tax credits that were mentioned in the previous session are actually really important to most practices. About half of our docs are still in, you know, 1 to 4 physician practices or provider practices. I can tell you my husband was in one of those until very recently, and the health insurance premiums were killing them too. So this will be very helpful for many of them, as well as a lot of things we're doing around streamlining claims processing and hopefully decreasing their cost of just submitting their claims to us. And finally, the increased coverage of preventive services is actually a fairly good payment for primary care. And not only do they reap the benefits, but the fact that the co-payments have been eliminated for the USPSTF services that we cover. But beyond the Affordable Care Act, we're doing other things as well. I don't know if any of you noticed that we just rolled out a proposal that will be finalized probably the end of this month to pay primary care providers for the first time for care coordination after someone's discharged from the hospital without a face-to-face encounter, because we know that's so important in terms of both the outcomes of the care, but also the cost of care and the quality in the end run. So a lot of stuff going on there, and it really has been in the works for a number of years. The first system that we put out that was really about addressing quality, this was just quality reporting initially, was the physician quality Quality Reporting System. It was a voluntary program that began in 2004, and we tend to front-load these programs so they have a big incentive up front, and then it diminishes over time and a payment adjustment kicks in. So we're now down to the point where the incentive is decreasing to a half a percentage of everything they bill under the allowed charges, basically, under our Part B fee-for-service schedule. And this program has evolved over time as it was designed to, but we're moving into the phase where a payment adjustment, which is our nice word for penalty, will kick in based on their performance in 2013. They won't actually get the penalty until 2015, but the performance is right around the corner that will be based on. E-prescribing is another incentive program that you may have heard of. Again, really designed these are all designed to improve quality. They can sound like they're isolated pieces, but together they become fairly powerful. This one, similar to PQRS, is front-loaded with incentives, but we're moving fairly quickly to a 2% payment adjustment for folks who are not successfully e-prescribing. And you've probably heard about our EHR, electronic health record incentives, which are not based on a percentage as are the others, but it's a set payment of up to about $44,000 for Medicare and $63,000 for Medicaid providers. So these combined with none of those, by the way, were under the Affordable Care Act. This is the only piece of this that was put in place by the Affordable Care Act, which is a value modifier that will be applied to all payments to physicians in 2017. We have to roll it out in 2015, and we've proposed to do that with groups that have 25 or more eligible professionals. It's very much aligned with PQRS, so basically if they try to report PQRS measures, they will not be assessed a penalty. But this penalty begins in 2015, can be as high as 1%. They also could get a 1% incentive, though. This is the first time we're really paying physicians based on quality. The Physician Quality Reporting System, e-prescribing, EHR, is all about doing something. It's not necessarily about improving care. This, we have to include measures of both quality and resource utilization. So we are really moving to a place to try and, to get us out of the situation they're in. There are a number of delivery system reforms. It appears that a few slides are not in here. Let me just say that there are a number of things that we're doing on the hospital side as well that are very much in step with what I just showed you on the physician side to move us again to a place where we have better quality but also lower cost so that we can meet the demands on the system. We also have a number of programs that really take us into a new area through our Center for Innovation that we just simply have not done before, including the Partnership for Patients and the Million Hearts campaign. These are both programs that are designed primarily. Partnership for Patients, if you're not aware of that, is to both reduce adverse events in the hospitals as well as readmissions. Million Hearts is to prevent 1 million stroke and heart attacks. We're doing those, particularly the latter one, but both of them very much in concert with CDC. New for us. I mean, a lot of this, I stand up here and it just kind of rolls out, but it's really transformational for us at CMS in shifting our interest to really think about outcomes, access, quality, and bring us much more in step, I think, with the concerns that you all have. The challenge before us is enormous. It really does require all of us working together, and it's great to be here with you to be part of that. Thank you. And I think we have time for one question, if there is one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson.
Our last speaker is Susan Allen from the Northwest Center for Public Health Practice, University of Washington, who will be speaking on whooping cough outbreaks and diminishing public health resources. And I might say, as an aside, that if you want the real nitty-gritty of what it means to be suffering from whooping cough, you can ask Barry because he and his wife have both had it recently.
I'm going to leave the slide on just so they'll keep recording.
Okay. I don't have a PowerPoint for this. I thought I'd give it a try this way. It's been a while since I've used just a simple text. What I'm going to try to do is tell you two short stories and then try to connect them and see how they interconnect. And the second one is about the reductions in public health workforce funding and staffing in the last 4 to 5 years. The first one is about pertussis or whooping cough. So how many of you have heard that there have been outbreaks of whooping cough in the United States this year? How many of you have double-checked either that your boosters are up to date or got a new booster? Good idea. In addition to Barry's experience, I have my own to share, and it's not a pretty story. One of the points I'll make, in fact, is that although the biggest focus is on the risk to infants, it actually is a non-trivial impact for older children and adults. It can keep you away from work and in the doctor's office or just simply totally disturb sleep for months and months and months. So the whooping cough outbreak got the first attention in the United States this year in Washington State when they declared in April an epidemic, a state of epidemic, unprecedented. The Secretary of Health said she'd never had to do that in her like 12-year career at the state, and she'd never heard of it being done previously in the state. And that was based on the fact that Washington State at that time was on a trajectory to have the largest number of cases since 1942, which was the era when widespread vaccination against whooping cough for pertussis first began. As it turned out, though, as the year unfolded, this was just not restricted to Washington State. 48 states and the District of Columbia have reported increased levels of whooping cough. And as of the current time, two states actually have higher numbers, higher rates than Washington State, and that's Wisconsin and Minnesota. And there are a couple of others whose epidemics have started more recently and are on a fast trajectory. So to give a sense of that, this is 32,000 cases. This is a vaccine-preventable disease that we had reduced to very, very modest limits not that long ago. And this year, to date, 32,000 cases, 16 deaths. Those deaths are more than half among infants under 3 months of age. They're the ones most likely to die. But again, as I mentioned earlier, anybody can get sick, and especially adults or younger or older children with underlying heart or respiratory illnesses can become quite ill, quite impaired for a period of time. This is one of the most contagious human diseases that we know of. So we really do have to depend on herd immunity, on having massive vaccination and not just the protection of the individual, because the per person impact is not as high as we would like. So it's the cumulative benefit that we need. And then the risk from a single exposure in unvaccinated children living with someone with pertussis, 90% likelihood they will get infected, almost 100%, almost definite. And even in attending a school with someone in the larger vicinity of a daycare or a school with whooping cough, it's 50 to 80%. So, you know, it's at least half and far more than likely. So basically, the presence of someone with whooping cough and someone who is vulnerable, that person is vulnerable, is very, very likely to get sick. It's the only vaccine-preventable disease that is associated with increasing deaths in the United States in recent years. Vaccine-preventable and increasing deaths, and it's unique in that risk. The second story is about the funding cuts and reductions in staffing for state, local, and tribal public health agencies. As of April of this year, more than 52,000 positions have been lost from state and local public health since 2008. I see some of you shaking your head. We should all be shaking our heads. For state and territorial workforce, that's a loss of about 17%. For local public health, it's a loss of about 22%. So basically, if you think across state and local, and look back to 2008, 5 workers then, 4 workers now. And those reductions have been disproportionate in different areas of the country and different kinds of programs. Almost all of the states, 91% of states and territories, report significant services being cut. And 62%, well over half, have eliminated whole programs, whole program's gone in 5 years from more than half of the states as a result of this. So what you're getting is both, you've got kind of creeping back on the margins so that they're weakening the ability of the programs that remain and services now where there are holes where there were services previously. And some places have been hit much harder than others. I know of a couple of states where the revenues have held and they've not been defunding. In Washington state, quite a number of our local health departments have lost 40% of their staff in the last 4 to 5 years, 40% of their staff. And they have eliminated major programs. One local health department in particular, because the funding comes from different places, so it's driven by federal cuts, state cuts, and local cuts, their epidemiology program, where they do the disease identification investigation, used to have 5 staff. Now they have 2. And this is one of the counties that's struggling with whooping cough. So we get into the question of what's the relationship between these two. Whooping cough is up, public health staffing is down. Well, it's not a totally simple story, but here's something, a New York Times article in May of 2012 about the Washington State outbreak. Well, it's very interesting. It just took me out of so much for the text here. I'll get it back in a minute. Too many fingers here. The technical glitch is the operator. This is a quote, "The response to the epidemic has been hampered by the recession, which has left state and local health departments on the front lines of defense, weakened by years of sustained budget cuts. Here in Skagit County, about an hour's drive north of Seattle, the hardest hit corner of the state based on pertussis cases per capita, the local public health department has half the staff it did in 2008. Preventive care programs intended to keep people healthy are mostly gone." Now, there are many factors that have contributed to the increase in whooping cough cases. And certainly one of them is that immunization rates have dropped in some states. Washington State, back when all of this started, actually had one of the lowest rates of immunizations for young children, one of the highest opt-out rates. I'm glad to say that a change in the law that it has required that to opt out, the parent has to certify that they've consulted with a physician first, has actually improved the rates, so they're catching up some. But the opt-out rates are fairly high across many pockets of the country. We also know that there's a greater evidence that since the vaccine was reformulated some years ago in response to unfounded fears that it was causing neurologic issues, that it probably causes weaker sustained immunity. So we do get people who, many years after they've had the vaccine, the immunity wanes, and across the population, you start to get that as a factor. So it's not just the health department reductions. But how might the health departments be contributing to this or be affected by it in some ways? Certainly, with the reductions in programs and in staffing, health departments have been less aggressive about ensuring immunizations are complete. So for children, not just that they're getting some of their shots, but they're getting all of their shots. This requires monitoring school records, going into physicians' offices and checking. There's not the staffing to sustain that at those previous levels, which is probably always not even previously not what we would have liked. There's less opportunity to engage with the medical community in detail, as we would have preferred as well, to make sure that the physicians think about the fact that they need to report these cases, that they need to be able to work closely with the health departments. There's also the question of being able to identify and track the cases themselves. One of our health departments in Washington State has changed its outbreak investigation guidelines. So where they used to investigate, depending on the disease, for 1, 2, or 3 cases, now they're not investigating until there's more cases, or they're only doing a cursory administrative investigation instead of a really in-depth investigation. So by actually altering their threshold of collecting this information or of reaching out to what's out there. So what we're getting is that the risk is going up, and that the ability the capacity of the state health departments to use the multiple fronts of vaccination, case tracking, physician engagement, public engagement are diminishing, that's probably allowing the outbreaks to increase even beyond what they need to. This applies not just to whooping cough, that's a disease that we see it in right now, but this would apply to any communicable diseases, and these reductions are putting us all at risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Allen. We have time for one or two questions before we conclude the session. Are there any? Yes, please.
It is hard, and some of the most effective. One of the things that really made a turnaround in Washington State, you all heard his question, sort of how do you reach some of the anti-vaccinators who are often in other ways more liberal and progressive, but probably are not very scientifically informed or are almost translating their big pharma opposition into not getting vaccines. Did I capture your question right? One of the things that Washington State did that was very helpful, I mean, the problem's quite real and the answers aren't easy. And it would be nice if people had a little public health education in their high school curriculum before they graduated high school. I think that's one of my secret public health dreams. But they had a young mother who had chosen not to vaccinate her child, and her child subsequently died of pertussis. And that woman was willing to come forward and be interviewed, you know, be part of a public service announcement. So that was someone who said, I understand this, I felt this way myself, but I've seen the cost. And then there was another one from a mother whose child is immunosuppressed because of a congenital disorder, whose child is at risk from all of the other children. And she says, I've done everything I can to protect my child, but I need your help. So those have been, they're not the whole answer, but I've seen more success with those than I have for the more rational approaches. It's very fearful because one of the other things I edited out, but I'll comment on here, was I do think that we're in an era where the we're all in it together motivation is perhaps not as powerful as it might once have been. Parents who are protecting their child from whatever harm they see with the vaccine without perhaps the same sense of shared responsibility for everybody else's children in the community that there might have been in a different era. I certainly remember when I was getting the polio vaccine in the early years of the newer forms. And it was a sense that it was a community responsibility, not something we were doing for ourselves. But I hope that there's more good thought and people explore ways to address that very important thing you raised. So.
Any other questions? Yes, please.
Right. So it's not just vaccinating little kids to protect them, but the fact is that the disease moves around because of what's in adults, and that's a completely new strategy.
I think that's true. If all of the kids were immunized, it would be a big advance, but it's not sufficient. This is a multifaceted problem, like most problems in public health are.
Thank you very much, Dr. Allen. Dr. Carol Allen and I would like to thank all the presenters and all of you for your attention. We encourage you to come up and speak to the individual speakers if you have some additional questions. Take care.